Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers are called to be as gods.
You know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location in a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Is it the opening shot of the apocalypse or the beginning of the end for the Islamic State? Welcome to A View from the Bunker. Our guest is someone who's qualified to speak to this. He is a veteran of the 101st Airborne, where he served as an Arabic linguist. He is a consultant to U.S. Special Operations Command, featured recently in War Stories with Oliver North on the Fox Business Network. More importantly and more to the point, he's the author of an important book that we recommend, 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps, Essays on Muslim Eschatology from 2005 to 2015. His website is MahdiWatch.org. We welcome back to the program Dr. Timothy Furnish. Tim, good to talk with you again.
Glad to be back, Derek.
We're seeing in the news reports that the Turkish military, possibly assisted by U.S. Special Forces, members of the Free Syrian Army, which are the so-called moderate Syrian rebels, the moderate Islamic rebels that are have risen up against the Assad regime, are just a few miles away from Dabiq in Syria, northeast of Aleppo. That's not their goal. They just have to go through there to get to the town they want to take, which is an ISIS stronghold called Al-Bab. But Dabiq, of course, is, you know, as you pointed out in your work, the because of a hadith attributed to Muhammad, one of the locations where Sunni Muslims believe they will fight a climactic battle with the forces of Rome. So if the Turks and whoever else is part of this coalition are just a few miles away from Dabiq, and they actually roll up on the city, how hard will ISIS fight to keep it, and what happens if they lose?
Well, they're going to fight very hard. But let me just back up real quick, Derek. It's actually – the Turks are engaged in airstrikes, but it's not actually Turkish military on the ground. It's a Turkman, Turkish-supported militia called the Sultan Moran Brigade.
Okay.
So, yeah, so Turkish forces are not actually involved, I mean, at least openly. But they are backing – there's a very small population in Syria of what are called Turkmen, and I think it's like 2-3% of the population. They're ethno-linguistically similar to the Turks, but they're not exactly the same. This is who's being supported. And this is one of those quote-unquote – moderate groups, you know, that we're behind, you know, but it's interesting because these folks are more Turkish and not the Arab groups that we wasted $500 million on last year.
Yeah, to put 5 men in the field. Yeah.
Put 5 men in the field. Right. Right. So anyway, that's who's fighting for Dabiq. Yeah. Again, the Turkish Air Force, I believe, is involved in airstrikes, but they don't actually have boots on the ground. So anyway, that does not change the tenor of your question, however, which is, how hard is ISIS going to fight, and why, and what does it mean if they actually lose the town? There are hadiths. There are hadiths, alleged sayings of Muhammad, that mention this town called Dabiq and a related area which seems to have existed in ancient medieval times, but is not there anymore, a place called Al-Amaq. And according to this hadith, which, you know, people Google it can find, and it's actually pretty easy to find. It's fairly lengthy, and some of it's a little hard to grasp. It's fairly lengthy and somewhat hard to grasp in some ways, but it basically says that, as you pointed out, the main points are that a Muslim armies will fight an army of, as they call it, Al-Rum. Al-Rum was the Arabic term, the Muslim term for the Byzantines, because the Byzantines, of course, the Eastern Romans who were Christians, never called themselves Byzantines. In fact, I just lectured on this recently in class, the college class I'm teaching this year. And I said, you know, if you landed on Earth in anywhere between, you know, 600 AD and 1453 AD and said, please take me to the emperor of the Byzantine Empire, people would have said, what are you talking about? This is a Roman. So Al-Rumiyya, which, by the way, is also the name of a new magazine, that ISIS is publishing along with its Dabiq magazine, Al-Rumiyya, is the Romans. And they do this really sort of interesting exegetical gymnastics where they say that the Romans, the Byzantines, of the Hadiths, and these Hadiths were probably written in the 800s, 700s, 800s AD, they conflate them, basically. ISIS conflates them with Crusaders, which, of course, the Crusades didn't happen until 200-300 years after that, after these Hadiths were written. And then, of course, they conflate them with us because, ironically, considering how many Americans view their own government with some degree of accuracy, which is as purely secular and not Christian at all, to ISIS, and they've said this repeatedly in Dabiq magazine and other places, ISIS believes that we are a Christian nation and we are the heirs to the Crusaders. And so they believe that they're going to fight this big battle here up near the Turkish border, north of Aleppo. They're this in or around this town of Dabiq. And the Hadith says basically a Muslim army will defeat a much larger army of Western Christians, basically. And then after that, after the Muslims win, the Mahdi will appear, the Islamic Messiah figure of, in this case, of Sunni tradition, not the same as the 12 or Shia one.
Right.
And also then at some point, right about the same time, and it's a little fuzzy on the exact chronology, the Mahdi will come, the Mahdi who is, of course, the main messianic figure, and then Jesus will show up, and then the Dajjal, the Islamic Antichrist, will appear, and Jesus will kill him, and then it sort of drops off, and then you have to go to other hadiths to find out what happens. But basically what happens after that is the belief, again, to which ISIS is not the only ascriber. This is a firm belief among huge percentages, perhaps a minority, but still huge numbers, something like probably north of 40% of the world's Muslims. They believe all this, after which at some point the Muslims will eventually take over the entire world, led by Jesus and the Mahdi. So ISIS believes that in these battles that they're fighting in Syria, particularly, and specifically in and around Dabiq, they believe that they are setting off the eschatological timetable for the Islamic conquest of the world. This is what they believe. And again, this is not particular to ISIS. These ideas have been around for a long time, and they've been shared by a lot of other Muslims. It's just that ISIS, instead of just writing books about them and opining about them, is actually going out onto the battlefield and trying to make them a reality.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and this is me showing my own ignorance here. I know that ISIS has named its press group, its news organization, PR group, if you will, after this other location, Al-Amaq.
Right.
Yeah, and I was under the impression that the Amaq Valley was a location near the Turkish city of Antakya, the old Antioch.
Yeah.
Is that the location, or was there another one?
Actually, there's some dispute about that, but that is probably the most likely candidate at this point, yes.
Okay. So there's an out. If they happen to lose Dabiq, they can just say, oh, well, okay, it was really supposed to be the other place.
Right. Because the Hadith actually contains references to both. Yes, that's a good point.
Huh. Okay. Now, there have been some special forces, or at least special forces assisted or advised the Turks when they launched this Operation Euphrates Shield, which took the town of Gerabalus. And then there was that really awkward, in terms of the optics, episode where the special forces guys left the town that they had just taken, this village they had just taken, being jeered at by the members of the Free Syrian Army, who were calling them crusaders and dogs and infidels, and very likely
the moderate Free Syrian Army.
Yeah.
Surely you jest, Eric.
Well, yeah, it just makes me wonder at the wisdom of giving loaded weapons to people who hate us. the mind reels at all of this.
Well, I've been saying for like at least a year, we keep hearing the administration and John Kerry, the Secretary of State, and people like people on the other side like McCain and Lindsey Graham saying all this stuff about how we should be supporting these moderate groups. But they would never tell us who these moderate groups are, which led me to believe they really had no clue if there actually were any, and if they were, who they were. So, yes.
Well, and then last week, to complicate matters further, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said that as they push on to this town of Al-Bab, the Kurdish YPG is also moving towards Al Bab, and that the U.S. doesn't want to see the Turkish military or the Free Syrian Army in Al Bab because they might start fighting each other, which raises another layer of complexity.
Very likely they will. Yeah. The YPG, yes, for people that don't know, it's Kurdish unit, Kurdish groups. And in Turkish, it's really Yekineyen Parastina Gel or something like that. In Kurdish, actually. But the YPG, I always have to go back to YPG is the Syrian version of the PKK. Yes. And the PKK is Marxist. So
okay.
Yeah, what you have with the PKK and the YPG are they're they're Kurdish, but they're basically they're a secular state movement for the Turks, excuse me, for the Kurds to have a state. Of course, for the Kurds to get a state, you'd have to carve away chunks from Turkey and Syria and also Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And Iran. And
Iran, yes.
Yeah.
So they are fighting for sort of Kurdish nationalism. And I'm not sure how Marxist they are anymore, but they kind of have used Marxist ideology as a way to avoid becoming Islamist, I guess we could say.
Hmm.
So they are particularly hated by ISIS, and they're particularly hated by many of the other groups because, A, they're Kurdish, not Arab, and, B, they're not Islamic, they're Marxist. So, yes, there's a very good chance that the YPG would wind up fighting with the others because, actually, they're quite good at fighting. They're one of the better fighting units against ISIS.
Yeah, so the irony here is that the best fighting group allegedly allied with the United States really doesn't have the goal of taking out Bashar al-Assad as long as he's willing to allow them a de facto independent zone, which they've already got in Syria and they've got in Iraq, but they've also got that little enclave in northwestern Syria that's cut off, and they're trying to connect those right. regions, which is what the Turks don't want, and which is why the Turks are setting up an independent or rather a buffer zone
right.
inside the Syrian border.
That's exactly right. You're exactly right, Derek, and you know more about it than just about anybody in D.C.
That's sad because I don't claim to be an expert on this.
Well, you and I think try to do the same thing, which is we try to just analyze and not let our ideology get in the way. Whereas in D.C., there are two people with vested ideological interests, and they don't like when the facts contradict their vested ideological interests. The facts are the first thing to go away.
Wow.
That's just the way they do it.
Well, and the sad thing, and this is what I think is really tragic, is that the lifeblood of middle America, the patriotic Americans who are proud that their sons and daughters are going to serve, are the ones who are being used as pawns in this great game. Well, anyway,
yeah.
taking the conversation further afield than I intended, so let me bring it back to the situation on the ground and the ideology of the Sunnis and how this plays into it here. The Islamic State went out of their way to take Dabiq early in the conflict, shortly after they declared themselves a state in 2014.
Right.
There's been intense fighting around Aleppo going on for months. One of the oldest cities in the world is being destroyed because of the ongoing fight between, it's like the Battle of the Five Armies or something, except that all five armies are fighting each other.
Right. The city is much larger and it's.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable when you go back in the history of Aleppo and see that this was the center of a powerful kingdom back around the time of Abraham, and it's been continuously occupied ever since. And
it, by the way, is the largest city, at least it was, the largest city in Syria. People think it's Damascus. No, Damascus is number two. Aleppo is the biggest.
Right, right. And the reason we don't know more about this ancient kingdom, which was Amorite, actually, called Yom Kad, if I pronounce it correctly, is that we've not been able to dig up any of their archives because they're people living on top of them and have been living on top of them for the last 4,000 years. And now there's even more rubble on top. Again, what is the Islamic State's long game here? I mean, when we went to war in World War II against Hitler and Germany, we assumed that the Germans, that the war was over when the Germans surrendered. Now, there are those who would argue, and there's some evidence to suggest that the Nazis never really quit. They just went underground, emigrated to Russia and to the West via the rat lines and Operation Paperclip and so forth. But there was a nation state involved.
They just all joined the Trump campaign, Derek.
that's right. The George W. Bush campaign, every Republican nominee. But at least there was a nation state involved where somebody could say, that's it, we surrender, our soldiers are going to stand down. What happens if the Islamic State gets pushed out of Dabiq, and then perhaps if the Iraqi government ever gets around to attacking Mosul, which they've been promising to do for a year, and takes Mosul? What happens to the Islamic State? Do they just say, okay, that's it, we give up?
Oh, no, no. You know, they've got, remember, that although they have the contiguous territory, the so-called caliphate there in Syria and Iraq, they have branches, groups that have declared bay'a or allegiance to them, all across North Africa and other parts of the Middle East, even over into South Asia. Particularly, you know, they're fighting to keep a stronghold in Libya right now. They're active in many other places. Boko Haram has basically declared themselves the West African province of ISIS. Yeah. So, you know, let me say, this is all part of that discussion. For months, we've been reading about how ISIS is on its last legs, right, Derek? We keep hearing that they're weak. You know, the administration keeps claiming that one of the reasons they're attacking, you know, they're inspiring lone wolves in the West is because they're so weak. And I'm not really sure I buy that argument. Even if we assume, however, arguendo, that they are losing territory in Syria and Iraq, two things. One is they have territory, again, as I just said, in other places. Now, whether, you know, al-Baghdadi could relocate or not is another question. And by the way, the story the other day about him being poisoned, I'm not sure I'm buying that one because it came from an Iranian news agency. And the Iranians are famous for doing this sort of thing.
Right, right.
A few months ago, remember there was a story about how, maybe it was a month or not even 6 weeks ago or something, that a story that ISIS had was banning the burqa because people were using it to blow them up. Did you see that?
No, I managed to miss that one.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was a red herring plant from the Iranian news agencies trying to just basically sow discord among supporters of ISIS. Hmm. You know, the Iranians are good at this sort of thing. But I mean, the thing that kills me is we keep falling for it. Anyway, two things I said. One is that even if they're losing territory in their contiguous caliphate right now, that doesn't mean that they don't have other safe havens to go to. They have places in Libya. I mean, go Google it, see where they're at. They're in something like 38 different countries.
Right,
now.
Right.
Major enclaves, if you will, in Libya, West Africa, as I said, they're in Bangladesh, they're in Afghanistan, so they're around. And, you know, they're also fighting they're part of the fight in Yemen. They're down there in Yemen in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. So there's that. The other part, I think, is that even if they were to lose all of their territory, they could simply go back to being what they were before they declared a territorial caliphate, which is, you know, your standard issue Islamic terrorist group. Their ideology, it really is not suffering any. Again, part of the problem with this is this: people won't discuss it honestly. You know, ISIS ideology, as I said on that Fox News special that you mentioned, as I said on Bill Bennett's show, as I've said in a lot of places, as I write in my books, ISIS ideology is really, in many ways, not radical at all. It is actually mainstream Sunni jihadist ideology, or as, you know, some folks in SOCOM will honestly say, Salafi jihadism, that's been around for, maybe not since the time of Muhammad, but one could argue in a sense since the time of Muhammad, but certainly since the time of Ibn Taymiyyah in the 14th century AD. And their viewpoint is shared, arguably not by a majority of Muslims, but by a very large plurality of Sunni Muslims. So it's not something that just a very small fraction of people believe in. And therefore, as long as they exist, as long as any member of ISIS exists, and for that matter, Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or Boko Haram and any of the other 40 or so terrorist groups on the State Department list, two-thirds of the entire groupings on there are Muslim groups, and almost all of them, except with a couple of exceptions, basically share the same ideology, which, by the way, is almost not discernibly different at all from Wahhabi Islam in Saudi Arabia.
Hmm.
I mean, so anyway, their ideology, even if they lose Dabiq and you lose territory and their actual caliphate collapses. ISIS is still going to be a problem because they'll go to ground somewhere else, at least some of them will. And they've still got this ideology that, again, that a substantial minority of Muslims agree with.
Hmm. One of the interesting bits of news that's come out in the last week or so is that the report, the Washington Times and a couple of other news agencies reported that the Special Operations Command, U.S. Special Forces, are pushing the staff of General Joseph Dunford, Marine Corps General, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff right now, to include an analysis of Sunni ideology, Salafist ideology, in the national military strategy, which has not been done before. Well, for people who don't know, what is the national military strategy, and what would be the impact of – how significant is it that SOCOM is pushing to get this included?
Yeah, that's the quadrennial one, right? Yeah. I believe it comes out every 4 years.
No, yeah. this is an annual thing, actually.
Oh, that's the annual one, not the quadrennial one.
Right.
Yeah. That's good. They should put it in both of them. Whether they will or not remains to be seen. But the military does a couple of different versions of sort of strategy, and they're trying to look ahead. That one is the one they do every year, looking forward. What's going to be the important issues the United States military will be facing in the next year. And then they do the quadrennial one. And I think there's also one they do like every 10 years or something.
Hmm.
That's the year to year one. SOCOM, Special Operations Command, for folks that don't know, the U.S. military is divided. The world is divided into, combatant commands, right? We have European Command, Northern Command, mm-hmm. SOUTHCOM, which is South America, PACOM, which is Pacific Command, and you've got a general or an admiral in charge of each of these. There's AFRICOM. CENTCOM is basically the Middle East, although Egypt is tacked onto that one. Now, the only command that's not like the others is Special Operations Command, because it's the only one that's not geographical. So Special Operations Command, where I worked from 2009 to 2014, is in many ways, and apologies to the others, but Special Operations Command is literally and figuratively the tip of the spear against terrorism.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
They are the only combatant command that can operate in the realms of the other ones without express permission, basically, because when they go after terrorists, it doesn't, the guys may go from, Egypt to Pakistan to Indonesia. So you're going across a couple of different commands there. So Special Operations tends to, frankly, annoy the other commands. And I know this, again, from working there for 5 years. The others get annoyed with them. CENTCOM in particular gets annoyed with them because CENTCOM, of course, has fought the major wars in the Middle East, our invasions of Iraq and so on. Was heavily involved in Afghanistan one. So they sort of resent Special Operations people as sort of interlopers in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But Special Operations Command, which is the smallest of all the commands, because you realize that you don't basically have like things like tanks in Special Operations Command because you may be able to use them. But Special Operations, for reasons stemming basically from what it does, which is basically fight asymmetric warfare, has I think had a better grasp on reality, shall we say, than other branches, particularly CENTCOM. I mean, famously, I worked down at SOCOM again at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, and SOCOM's on one part of base, and about, I don't know, quarter of a mile away is CENTCOM. CENTCOM is much bigger. I mean, it's a bigger combat command because they also fight conventional wars in CENTCOM. And CENTCOM has the reputation for being much more politically correct. So what you have here, I hope it works out, and what you have is a bit of sense being injected into national military strategy and the office of the Joint Chiefs by special operations people. And, the CENTCOM people took a really big hit the last couple of years because that's where we had all this cooking of analysis, this data.
Right.
People were being encouraged, to put it mildly, to tailor their analysis to fit the narrative coming out of the White House. And this is where you got that crap like, ISIS is the JV team.
Right.
Because president wanted ISIS to be the JV team. Now, you know, I'm sure every administration to some degree, you politicize intelligence some, but this is the worst I've ever heard of.
Hmm.
So, now Salafi jihadism. Okay. That's specifically what SOCOM once put in. And frankly, I have to say they're kind of shocked because when I last worked there in the fall, about this time in fall of 2014, they were really heading to, I was afraid they were heading toward the PC-ness of CENTCOM. It looks like someone's fighting it, thank God. Salafi jihadism, okay, everyone knows what jihadism is, okay? That means to fight jihad, which, again, is not something that ISIS just dreamed up recently, not something that al-Qaeda dreamed up. It's enshrined in the Quran, and Muhammad himself engaged in jihad. So I've never quite understood how jihad could be radical when the founder of the religion engaged in it.
Yeah.
Anyway, now the other part of that is Salafi, right? Salafi derives from the Arabic term Salaf, which is a term that means the pious ancestors. It's the compatriots of Muhammad in the early days when the Islamic community was being created. So it's sort of roughly analogous to when someone says they're in our faith, when someone says they're being apostolic. They're trying to do something just like the apostles did. Of course, you know, the difference is, of course, the apostles didn't lead armies and conquer places.
Right.
So it's kind of like that. But Salafi has become shorthand for what, when I was in graduate school at Ohio State back in the 90s, when I was doing my PhD in Islamic history, we used to just call Islamic fundamentalism. It was acceptable to say that. And it's quite accurate, too. It's the idea that you try to do things just like Muhammad did. You try to go by the book literally with the Quran. So that's what Salafi means. Okay, it's basically fundamentalist Sunni Islam. And it is very similar. I mean, again, there's almost no difference between that and Wahhabi Islam in Saudi Arabia, the name of which comes from a guy who was a proponent of Salafi Islam called Ibn Abdul Wahhab, who was the basically 18th century version of this, and whose ideas are still followed in Saudi Arabia. So basically, I think whoever came up with this is actually a very smart thing to do, because as we know, the president and no one in his administration, not only will they not say that Islam has anything to do with terrorism, they actively fight against the idea. I mean, just recently, the president talked again about that. He gave an interview, who was it to, a week or two ago, and repeated that same garbage, I can't remember, Derek. I just saw it. It was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it was so routine, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it.
Oh, it was like a town hall. It was some sort of town hall thing, and it was at a military installation, I believe, recently. And one of the persons there, or it was a wife of someone who was deployed or something like that, asked him about that, and he went off on a tirade again about why, like he was personally offended, why he had to explain this again, why he wouldn't use the term Islamic terrorism, when of course that's exactly what it is. So bringing up Salafi jihadism would be a vast improvement if we were to start using that term, a vast improvement over this stupid terminology of extremism or radical Islam, right? So, but you know, I don't know if it'll fly, Derek, because as you know, some of your listeners may not, but you know, for several years, I had a couple different lecturing jobs, one at Joint Special Operations University, one at Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, which is a DHS training facility down here in Georgia near Savannah.
Hmm.
And I was cut out of both of those positions because I was told that although I had been tasked with lecturing on history of terrorism and discussing Islamic terrorism, that after the Obama administration came into power, the edicts had come down that no one would be employed who talks about jihadism or jihad. although, of course, that's what our enemies talk about all the time, but we can't talk about it. So it would be interesting and it would be very, very helpful if this sort of terminology would come back in. And again, it's not just hair splitting. It's not just name calling. If you are trying to counter an ideology, you have to accurately describe the ideology. Okay? You cannot counter this Islamic ideology of jihad, of beheadings, of terror, which derive from the Quran and the Hadiths and the examples of Muhammad himself, who ordered beheadings of opponents. You cannot counter that unless you're willing to talk honestly about what it is. And this administration, of course, has not only, as I said a moment ago, not only not talk honestly about it, actively fought and vilified those who would talk honestly about it. So we'll see if this flies. You know, I like to think a Marine with four stars on his shoulders can stand up to a president like this, but we'll see.
Yeah, it will be. Will be interesting to see, because the reports that I've read have given the impression that the General Dunford's staff, anyway, is resistant to the idea. But we'll see. Yeah, it was a surprise to read that General Nagata, Michael Nagata, and this was about a year and a half ago, December of 15, reportedly brought together a group of college professors who specialized really in marketing and branding. To try to
yeah,
figure
that
out
was
what,
December of 2014. They didn't ask me.
Okay. Yeah, 2014.
Nagata.
And,
it was in the New York Times.
Yeah, right. And said, you know, we just can't figure out what's going on with these guys. So we're trying to figure out from these college professors.
Don't know what motivates ISIS.
Yeah.
That's what he said, Derek.
Yeah, and it was.
So, you don't get stars on your shoulder without being a very bright guy. So either he's the exception and he was one of the idiots that got through to general rank, or he's just spinning horse hockey, as a military man I greatly admired named Colonel Sherman Potter used to say.
We're gonna
bring together some marketing people who, you know, don't know the front end of the Quran from the back, and then we're gonna advise us on how to create a counter narrative against ISIS.
Yeah.
Is it any wonder we're losing the ideological war game?
Well, it's like when John Kerry went out to Hollywood and sat with a bunch of screenwriters to figure out the branding and try to figure out what was going on by talking to screenwriters in Hollywood.
Process, not substance. I've seen this for so many years. I see this with the State Department and the intel agencies. I see these people who are very bright. But what they do is, in the State Department and the intel agencies, they'll go hire somebody with a bachelor's degree in political science from, you know, Harvard or Princeton or an MBA from somewhere like that. And then the idea is they're very bright, so we can turn them into an area expert. This is not how it works. Okay, you can't be an area expert unless you know at least one of the languages of the areas. And yes, that's my Orientalism speaking. But if you're going to be a Russia expert, you better damn well know how to speak, read, and write Russian. Okay, if you're going to be an expert on East Asia, you better know how to read, speak, and write at least one of the major languages there, Korean, Japanese, or Chinese, okay? If you're going to be a Middle East expert and opine on this issue, you damn well better know either Arabic, Persian, or Turkish. And certainly in that congeries right there, Arabic is the most important one. But I've seen so many self-styled experts that can't read a lick of Arabic and don't know much about the history going back more than 20 years, but yet they're helping write policy. And to be fair, Derek, let me be fair. There are people on what I consider our side that are doing this too. There are many people that are put forward as experts on the conservative side that don't know a damn thing about the Middle East.
Yeah.
Don't have credentials either.
You see them put up on Fox News and other outlets on a regular basis, and more because they look good on camera than because they actually know what they're talking about.
Well, a lot of people are retooled Soviet experts. They were people that were I mean, there are some people I really like. I won't mention any names, but, you know, they have PhDs or they have advanced degrees in, say, Soviet studies or Russian studies. And that doesn't necessarily, in fact, it probably doesn't at all transfer over into studying what we're doing now. Well, I mean, the issues that we're trying to counter now, which is the issues of Islam and Islamic terrorism.
So the trend,
of course, on the other side, what you have is the people that actually are the experts in our field are a bunch of like flaming leftists. That, you know, I don't want to let anywhere near any sort of policy decisions. Okay. Like people like Esposito at Georgetown, who's basically paid by the Saudis, or people like Juan Cole at Michigan.
Yeah.
Who is just reprehensible in the way he slanders those that disagree with him. And in particular Cole, I mean, I've read some of his books. I mean, he's a very solid academic. But he turns that into basically vilifying anyone that's to the right of Karl Marx that disagrees with him on
it. And it can be tragic. A gentleman a friend of yours who you referred to me, and I found the interview with him fascinating, Pete Turner, who talked about his personal experience on the ground in Afghanistan in building trust and relationships with tribal elders in a part of the world where trusting an American is could possibly get you dead in a real hurry if you're not very careful about the way they approach it. And when he advised
on the State Department people,
yes. and he passed along what he had learned to the State Department folks, who took it and just filed it away. It's like, well, this is a grunt. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And
that's smarter than all of us, just like Obama's smarter than all of us.
Exactly. And sadly, it resulted in some people getting killed because they didn't follow protocols that he had worked out with the tribal elder for keeping people safe, not least of which were the Americans who were dealing with these tribal leaders. It's
right.
It is. And again, I'm certainly no expert, but I try to, you know, be sensitive to people who've actually had experience on the ground in a certain area. And listen to what they have to say.
Let me say something about that, Derek, if you don't mind, just for a moment.
Sure.
Look, there are people for whom I have a great deal of respect. Okay, like Robert Spencer. Look, I have a great deal of respect for Robert, and Robert has turned himself into a guy that knows more about Islam than a lot of, you know, self-styled experts in the field. Okay. Mm-hmm. But, okay, at the bottom of the day, Robert can't read a lick of Arabic, okay? And, you know, I don't know, maybe this is my academic showing, but, you know, because I busted my hump and lost all of my hair to get a PhD in Islamic Middle East history, right? I already knew Arabic from when I was in the Army. I took more Arabic when I went to Ohio State. I also studied Persian and Turkish and Ottoman Turkish, okay? Now, Arabic I still read fairly well. And Ottoman I can struggle through, which is a language that will make you go blind and probably crazy. But we have so many people on our side. And again, I'm not disparaging, but it's like they will miss things because they don't know. They just don't know enough about the background and the history and can go read something in the original language and figure out, you know, there's more nuances than that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I sound like a State Department guy, don't I? I don't want to sound like that. I mean, like Francis earlier that I like Michael Ledeen. I was on a panel with Michael Ledeen. I was at a conference at Army War College a few years ago with Michael Ledeen, and I have a great deal of respect for Michael. But look, he's an old Soviet expert, okay? And if I recall correctly, he doesn't even have a PhD. He has a master's degree in Soviet studies, okay? That's great. But now Ledeen is held up on the right as an expert on Iran. He can't read a lick of Persian, okay? He's never been to Iran. I can read Persian. I've been to Iran. So trust me, and I think there are still things about Iran that befuddle me. That you could spend your lifetime studying that country and that religion and that culture, and you still wouldn't get something right. So I don't know how someone that decides they're an expert because they started reading secondary sources for a couple of years, and who is trained in another field suddenly is an expert on this issue. And this shows up in that issue, like, you know, that thing you and I've talked about before. I mean, I just get attacked by people on the right because I don't go with the herd mentality on Iran, you know, that mm-hmm. Iran wants nukes because they're going to use them on Israel.
Right, right.
The cause of coming in 12th of Mon. I'm like, no, they don't. And Michael really got mad at me. I've lost friends over this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Andrew Bostom. I mean, I have a great deal of respect for Andrew Bostom. You know, he wrote those books on jihad. I don't know if you know who Andrew is.
Heard his name, but I've not read his work.
Oh, he basically unfriended me because I disagreed with him on this issue.
Huh.
And I'm like, Andrew, no offense, but you're a medical doctor. Okay, so I'm not going to tell you anything about pulmonary embolisms, and I'll make you a deal. And you don't tell me about Iran, because frankly, I know more about it than you do, and I've been there. So, but it just gets very brutal. And we run into this thing, and we get a lot of this on our side, too. And again, our side, I mean the conservative Christian side, because I'm conservative and I'm a Christian. I'm not an evangelical. We get a lot of this... We get a lot of this following after not quite false prophets, but false experts, because someone
right,
is a strong Christian does not make them an expert in the field of anything else except, you know, being a strong Christian.
Right. Right. No, that you're absolutely right about that. And we run into this at the prophecy conference in July. I included in my presentation, which was really more of an overview of the unseen spiritual war and the significance of holy mountains in the long game that's being played between God and the angels who have rebelled. But as part of that, I talked a little bit about prophecy, and I said, now, contrary to belief, and I drew on your work for, what we can expect out of Sunni and Shia Islam, and frankly, said that Shia Islam is far less of a threat, an apocalyptic threat than Sunni Islam, and here's why.
So he might come after you?
Well, no, actually, I was really surprised because I think a lot of the folks there are looking for good, solid information, but it certainly was not what they were expecting to hear because there were... It's not the message that you normally hear coming from conservative Christians.
It's not conventional wisdom on the right.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I can say this because, you know, 10 years ago, I was one of those guys who was doing standard issue conservative talk radio, calling the president of Iran, Mahmoud, I'm in a jihad. You know, haha, because I heard Sean Hannity say it. And I thought that, so it must be funny.
But, it is pretty good, actually.
Yeah, in a sense, but not necessarily accurate. That is a danger. And there's some aspects. I've been doing a lot of reading on ancient cosmology, and most of it comes from that part of the world because that's where the first really civilized humans lived, was in what is now Southeast Iraq and Western Iran.
Zoroastrians were really good at this.
And have been incorporating that into what I'm doing right now, but I would not dare call myself an expert on Mesopotamian religions, although there are some people are saying, well, you're an expert at it. No. I'm just reading papers. That's all. I'm trying to fit this together. And just because I say, you know, something that I've never heard that before. No, that's, I'm not an expert. It's just, there's this level of academia where you've got scholars, exchanging information that ought to be making it down to the pews because I think it's relevant and important, but there's no channel to bring it from one level down to the other. And we see the same thing and perhaps for different reasons in the news that is put forth for our consumption, or the product that is put forward as news for us to consume.
News has become niche, hasn't it? News has become segmented.
Yeah.
You know, people listen to Fox and they listen to Rush. And then I have friends that listen to CNN and God forbid, I don't know why, MSNBC. and well, at least I'll say CNN, there is news there, but you know, MSNBC, I'm not sure there is. But anyway, so yeah, people listen to their own, everybody listens to what their itching ears want to hear.
Right.
And
right.
They're not willing to step outside that and listen to maybe the other side. Not even that. It's not even that the other side may have a point. It may just be that by focusing on news that only is ready-made to fit your ideology, you might be missing something important.
Yeah. And one of the things that concerns me, and I know this is going outside the bounds of the original topic here, but that's something that concerns me about the drumbeats that I hear lately about Russia and the Russians invaded Crimea and the Russians invaded Georgia back in the day and the Russians are you know pounding Aleppo and they broke the peace treaty. Wait a minute, didn't the U.S. Air Force bomb the Syrian army outpost during that 7-day period that we were supposed to be under a ceasefire to get this peace deal in Syria going? It makes me wonder if we're not doing the same thing now, in terms of our coverage that the media is giving us on Russia, it's feeding maybe what our itching ears want to hear, but also maybe what we are supposed to think in order to get public support, to work up public support for whatever foreign policy initiative the neocons want to put before us next.
And I think both sides do that. I mean, clearly, a lot of people just say that Obama's the only one that does it. But yeah, you're right. That both the left and the right, both the Republicans and the Democrats in this country, unfortunately, I think it's more prevalent on the left, but many on the right do it too, which is they see foreign policy as an adjunct of domestic policy.
Yeah.
And they pick and choose what to emphasize about that. They pick and choose how to talk about foreign policy in terms of domestic policy. And you know, look, I know we're all prone to that because we're human, but I really, really try to avoid that. And like, for instance, and just a little small example here, but, you know, I've been asked to talk at a number of tea parties around here, tea party organizations, although I'm not one. You know, I'm sympathetic to much of the people. I've been asked to speak at some of them. And I ruffled some feathers a year or so ago when I spoke at a big tea party out here where I live in Cherokee County, Georgia, by telling people, stop saying that Islam is not a religion, because frankly, that just makes you look stupid. Because Islam is a religion. And there were people who wanted to argue with me. So this lady stands up and goes, well, that's just your opinion. And I went, yes, ma'am, that's true. But my opinion is based on about 20, 25 years of studying Islam. You know, The death of expertise, Tom Nichols. I don't know if you know Tom on Twitter, but Tom's wrote that article in The Federalist. He's writing a book about it. And Tom, who's a PhD Russia expert, by the way, but death of expertise, which is relevant to what we're talking about, which is you see this increasingly on the left and the right in this country that, experts don't know any more than anybody else does. And in a sense, you know, as a Democrat, small D, I can sort of see that. But in another sense, I know that I sure as hell don't know how my carburetor works, but the guy up at the corner does. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to go up there and tell that guy how to fix my car. I'm going to ask him politely to please fix my car. Okay. When I go to the doctor, I'm not going to tell the doctor I know more than him because I read something online. Okay. But yet when it comes to things like, you know, Syria or Islam or Iran, all of a sudden everyone's an expert because they read something online.
So, yeah. Yeah. And generally it's on Facebook or Twitter.
Exactly. Exactly. And again, left and the right does this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Absolutely. Well, yeah, it's what a friend, Dr. Mike Heiser calls the flight from reason, which, sort of typifies our world today. It is a postmodern reality where all that matters is how something makes you feel.
Well, and it's also sort of an uber application, if you will, of the American ideal. I remember I had this, this friend of mine, but she was much younger. She would have been an age of a student, that I was talking to at a coffee shop one time. And we were, I don't remember what we were discussing. She goes, opined on something. And I was like, well, actually, that's not really accurate factually, whatever she said. And she said, well, my opinion is as good as yours. I said, well, your opinion is as good as mine in the realm of the American Constitution and your right to express it. I said, frankly, your opinion is not as good as mine when it comes to something I know more than you about. Okay, but that's this sort of this uber idea. Anyone's opinion is as good as anyone else's. Well, no, actually, it's not.
Right.
You have an equal right to express it. But what's that famous? Was it Mark Twain, the famous saying about keeping your mouth and being
right
mouth shut, being thought an idiot rather than opening it, removing all doubt?
Right.
You have a right to open your mouth and remove all doubt all day long. But that's it's a double edged sword.
Yeah, but in today's world, kids are being brought up and taught that they that nobody has a right to say no. They were entitled to a safe space to be protected from contradictory ideas and feel bads. So
I'm teaching this year for the first time. I'm teaching undergraduates in 9 years, Derek, because I left teaching in 2007. So I'm teaching a local small university out here. I'm teaching world history, and then in spring I'm teaching Middle East history. I have to say, after 9 years away, I mean, I've been lecturing in military venues, I've lectured overseas, I've lectured in a couple seminaries and graduate schools and so on, but I've not taught undergrads. And I have to say, it's been profoundly disappointing how little the undergraduates know at a university at this point, which is supposed to be, it's a small university, but a university here in the area. And the other day, for instance, I was lecturing on, I'm up to Christianity and how the Roman Empire became Christian, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm working through Constantine, and I'm working through a lot of the Rodney Stark stuff. I'm sure you know Rodney Stark, you know, the sociological aspects of how Christianity came to be, you know, because I'm not going to say, well, you know, it's a divine miracle, even though it's ostensibly a Christian school. I have to come at it a little more historically than that. Uh-huh. Like, for instance, I asked one of the students, I said, well, I asked the class, and why did Pontius Pilate have Jesus put to death? And one kid goes, to atone for our sins. I said, well, now that's the right answer in theology class.
Yeah,
but we're in history class. Okay. Okay. You got to have something more utilitarian here, you know. Take it down a notch. You know, well, he's put to death because of treason, the charge of treason. But anyway, but it was disappointing. And this goes to what you're talking about. I actually have a point, which is that I'm in a class of kids, you know, in a very red state. In arguably the reddest county in a very red state, the vast majority of whom I'm sure are Christian kids, and they didn't know, most of them did not know the most basic thing about Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not the most basic thing. And then we wonder why. Now, most of them are the product of public schools where, you know, you're not supposed to talk about, you can talk about any religion probably except Christianity. We wonder why we're in such trouble. I mean, all the stuff you and I have just been talking about for 10 or 15 minutes. Why is it that people think anybody's opinion is good as another? Why is it that they can't, like, rationally make good decisions? Or critical thinking, as we used to say in the old days.
Right.
Because they aren't taught to. And this is largely, and again, I realize there are good public schools somewhere in America. I'm sure someone's seen one. But for the most part, this is the fault of the public schools.
And the fault of parents to insist on.
Yes.
Yeah, because if the parents are just sending them off and not and, and saying, okay, well, my job, that part of my job is being taken care of by me writing a check for my property taxes every year. It's been an abdication by the parents as well as by the school system.
And yes, and we wonder why we have a society where, you know, people are drifting away from the church. Why would anyone go join? I've studied Islam for 25, 30 years, okay? I don't think it's true, okay? I think Islam is a cobbled together religion from basically early Christian heresies.
Yeah.
And with a little bit of Judaism thrown in there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's exactly what I think Islam is. I think to the extent to which it has anything good in it, I think it's simply refracted through these Christian sects, heretical sects basically, okay? Why anybody would join Islam, particularly a woman would join that religion, is just beyond me.
Right.
As a rational human being. But yet we see it increasingly happening in this country. And it goes to what we were just talking about. And then, you know, the famous quote from Chesterton, it's often supposed that when people stop believing in God or Christianity, I forget exactly which one he said, when people stop believing in Christianity, they'll believe in, they believe in nothing. He said, no, it's worse than that. They'll believe in anything.
Right. Yeah, we're seeing the return of the old gods, and it's not, you know, the
I don't know, Derek, no, I wish it were the old gods, because frankly, I think Jupiter and Zeus, whichever way you want to look at them, I think Zeus is less threatening than Allah.
In some respects, yeah.
You know?
Now, I would argue that Zeus is just another manifestation of Baal, and so therefore you've got some issues, but I'm not one who says, well, yeah, Baal, that's the one who was, you know, sacrificing babies to. No, that's one of the points I made. It's like, you know, look, Baal child sacrifice, that's not that guy. I mean, I know you've heard that a lot from other Christian teachers that Baal was not a child sacrifice. Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, I brought that up in class a couple weeks or last week when I was doing the Roman Republic with the Carthaginians in the textbook.
Yes.
Totally left out that. Okay, look, the Romans were real jerks to the Carthaginians, to put it mildly. Okay,
right.
But one of the major reasons the Romans did that to the Carthaginians was because they were horrified that another civilization across the Mediterranean practiced child sacrifice.
Right.
You know? So, you know, it's sort of like with the conquistadors. We're getting far afield here, aren't we? But I mean, it's like with the conquistadors and the Aztecs, okay? The conquistadors were some real bastards in many ways.
Right.
But they weren't taking virgins up on the temple stone altar and ripping their hearts out while they were still breathing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do you want the guys that are forced to become Catholics, or do you want the guys that rip the hearts out and sacrifice them to Quetzalcoatl? I'll take the former any day and twice on Sunday, no pun intended.
No, absolutely. And the reason that kids don't know anything about that is because sociologists, historians, archaeologists have a bias toward presenting these ancient civilizations as sort of the noble savage that was a purer, simpler form of the time when life was good and everything was simple. Look, if you actually look
and
at the evidence,
they're better than Western Christian civilizations.
Yes, yes.
I mean, the kids all knew about the conquistadors and what jerks they had been.
Right.
But they didn't know about the Aztecs.
Yeah.
You know, the kids all knew that the Romans did some nasty stuff, but nobody knew about the Carthaginians.
Right. Right.
It's like Bizarro World. It's like we teach our children to hate our own civilization.
Right. Yeah. It's absolutely.
I mean, critical of it's one thing. We teach them to hate it.
Yeah. And is it any?
And I'm not sure when they get to me in college, I can fix that, Derek. I try, but, you know, many other people try, but I'm not sure we can fix it at that point.
And if you try to teach any kind of pride in your history, your family, your culture, suddenly that paints you as, oh, you're one of those white supremacist racist types,
intolerant.
Right?
You're the intolerant one.
Yeah.
If you're not willing to bring hundreds of thousands of people here who believe in Sharia law and a certain percentage of whom probably also believe in jihad, you're intolerant.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly what's been going on. When you look at the countries from which immigrants have been arriving on these shores, there's been a sharp increase in countries that are on the terrorist watch lists, like, Morocco and Algeria, Saudi Arabia and Syria, Afghanistan, and not to mention, what, something like 44 Afghan soldiers who were here to be trained that have disappeared over the last 2 years?
Right. Some of them right here in Georgia.
Yeah.
I think they're probably registering to vote even as we speak.
What a world. Come quickly, Lord. Dr. Timothy Furness, the author of 10 Years Captivation with the Mahdi's Camps, Essays on Muslim Eschatology, 2005 to 2015, a number of his other books as well. I will link to the website, MahdiWatch.org, and where you can find the book. And Tim, also, the books on Middle Earth, the political history of Middle Earth was wonderful. When is the military history coming forward?
I'm plugging away on it, Derek. I'm hoping next year, hoping next spring, maybe early next summer, because that one's going to be longer. Mm. Yes, military history of Middle Earth. It's very geeky, but I actually spoke at Dragon Con on the other one. Dragon Con is the big sci-fi fantasy convention here
over
Labor Day. Yes, I spoke on the book. So I was up against Shatner, who was speaking at the same time in another area. So for some reason, more people went to his thing, but I did have a fair number of people show up.
Well, it's I'm looking forward to it because the political history was a delightful read, and looking forward to it. But yeah, I know the task of trying to write where you're actually trying to earn a living around the edges of your time. I keep thinking if I keep telling people I'm writing a book that it'll shame me into finally getting it done. So
there you go. Right. Plus, I got two sons playing football at two different schools right now. God willing, you know, next year they'll both be in the same school. But right now it's just brutal getting them around.
So, well, you have an actual excuse then. I don't. So, Tim, appreciate your time today. Look forward to talking with you again.
All right. Thank you, Derek.
Again, Tim's website is MahdiWatch.org, MahdiWatch.org, where he posts his essays from time to time. And you'll find links there to some of his older essays, which have really been helpful to me in understanding better the nature of the conflict in the Middle East and what the players actually want. If you actually understand a bit more about their eschatology and what they believe, Sunnis, Shias, and the various sects therein, what's happening in the Middle East makes more sense. And it doesn't track, you begin to notice that it doesn't exactly track with what we're hearing from commentators in the news, which is why the conversation with Tim went the direction it did, and how people are being elevated to the status of expert in the eyes of the media, possibly because they're telling us what elites want us to be told in order to pursue certain agendas with the support of the public. So it was like the old joke in the business world. What do you call an expert or a consultant? A guy from out of town. So in the world today, of course, the big story, if you're in the Southeast, is Hurricane Matthew. By the time this is online, Matthew will probably have already made his run up the East Coast as far as the Carolinas and then headed back out to sea. The question is, what happens then? As I record this on Thursday afternoon, it appears that the track will then bend back around and head back toward Florida, make a U-turn, similar to what Hurricane Ivan did in 2004. But again, by the time you hear this or see this, if you're watching this on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, that question will probably already be answered. So we'll see what the weekend brings. We're just praying for those in the path of the storm, because this is a dangerous one, expected to hit Florida Thursday, Friday, with 125 to 135 mile an hour sustained winds. The first major hurricane to hit the United States since Wilma in 2005. The first Atlantic hurricane to place in the top 10 most powerful hurricanes in like 9 years. And of course, this runs counter to the accepted wisdom that our human activity on Earth is leading to more carbon dioxide in the air, which is leading to more powerful storms. You know, we've gone 10 years without a major hurricane, 11 years without a major hurricane hitting the United States. But the Paris Climate Accord, which is now official, the UN and its member states jumped to get it approved before the November election, just on the off chance that Donald Trump will win. It goes into effect within the next 30 days. So by mid-November, the Paris Climate Accord will be international law, albeit a law without an enforcement mechanism. So if Mr. Trump does win in November, he had promised to cancel it or renegotiate it. He really won't need to. He can just ignore it, which frankly he ought to do anyway, because the president, Mr. Obama, obligated the United States to this treaty, just like he did with the Iran nuclear deal, without running it past the Senate. I mean, the Senate is supposed to approve all treaties by a two-thirds majority, but by claiming, well, this is just really an administrative agreement between the administration of our government and the administration of the foreign. That's what a treaty is, right? So in my view, it's unconstitutional. You don't hear many Republicans saying that, though, just like you don't hear many Republicans saying that the practice of assassinating American citizens considered a security threat by the president without any judicial or congressional oversight is unconstitutional. I mean, read the Bill of Rights sometimes. You'll find that you cannot be deprived of life or property without due process of law and a trial by jury of your peers. And yet this president has taken the right of the presidency, has assumed powers that Dick Cheney never dreamed of in his most fevered nightmares. Assassinating American citizens like Anwar al-Awlaki and his 15-year-old son, who just happened to be sitting at the wrong coffee shop in Yemen at the wrong time when he got droned. It's unconstitutional. But you don't hear Republicans saying that very often. Which leads me to believe that the powers that be within the Republican Party are just waiting to get their hands on those levers of power again. Well, of course they are. That's why so many Republicans, high-ranking Republicans, are abandoning the party to vote for Hillary in November because Donald Trump is upsetting their apple cart. Now, will Trump be better on constitutional issues than Hillary or than Obama was or George W. Bush? I don't know. But he's the only candidate running this time around who might. So anyway, Paris Climate Accord, reporter for NBC actually said on a network broadcast that the Paris Climate Accord is designed to stop storms like Hurricane Matthew. Really? How exactly does that piece of legislation work? We're going to outlaw major hurricanes from making landfall in the United States? The lack, maybe he just misspoke. I don't know. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe the reporter just misspoke. But designed to stop storms like, my head explode. If you've got a Yahoo email account, you really, really, really ought to change your password right now. In fact, stop this MP3, go change your password, and then come back and listen to the rest. You should have done it a couple of weeks ago when the word first came out that Yahoo had been compromised and half a billion users' passwords have been compromised. If you've got a Yahoo account and you haven't changed passwords within the last few weeks, change it today because it's probably been compromised by a hacker. And now we find out why. Turned out that Yahoo had been requested, had been intimidated, had been told by the U.S. government, you will scan all incoming email to all of your users. Now, in 2007, Yahoo had had a similar demand where the government had come to it and said, we want you to scan all outgoing email from Yahoo users, Yahoo email accounts, to foreign recipients. They wanted this done without a warrant. This is like the post office just reading everybody's mail and deciding which email was worthy of further investigation on national security grounds. It's not supposed to happen. That's not supposed to be constitutional either. This is the kind of thing that the Bill of Rights is supposed to protect us from. And Yahoo fought it in court, arguing that it was unconstitutional. They lost. They lost. But the government threatened Yahoo with $250,000 a day fine if they didn't comply. $250,000 a day if they didn't comply. So that may be why in 2014, when the government came back and said, okay, now we want you to just scan everybody's email, Yahoo's CEO, Marissa Meyer, decided to go along with it. However, when she didn't bring her security team into the loop, apparently. This is according to people on the inside who've reported to the Washington Post. She turned to the email engineers at Yahoo to write the code needed to scan all the software for whatever it was that the government spy agency, and which agency it was not identified in the story, whatever they were looking for. This resulted in a coding error, a programming error that left all of Yahoo's email accounts open to hackers. And that's why more than 500 million user passwords are now in the hands of hackers, which is why I say again, if you haven't changed your Yahoo password recently, do it now. But this is the kind of government overreach the United States government is engaging in right now. Scanning everybody's email, half a billion email accounts without a warrant. And of course, it's just not Yahoo. Microsoft, Google, and Apple all, you know, came out and said, well, we've never been asked to do anything like that. And if we were, we would. Really? If you're listening to the MP3 right now, you're not seeing my face. Okay, that's for the video. That's an extra for the video viewers. The artificial intelligence chief hired by Facebook recently used to develop surveillance systems. That's his background. Surprised? Mm-mm. Facebook has done in the span of 10 years what the CIA couldn't do in 65 years, which was get the American public and people all over the world to volunteer information that we would never have given up under questioning. Who we like, who we don't like, who we hang out with, what our family's names are, you know, our routines, pictures of all of our family members. Basically, it's a treasure trove for the intelligence agencies, which is why some of the earliest investors, one of the earliest investors in Facebook, was the CIA's, or people connected to the CIA's venture capital firm, InQtel. It wasn't InQtel directly, but people who typically invest in technologies that are useful to the intelligence community. That is not a coincidence. One final story, and this is only because it's funny, or rather it would be funny if people didn't actually believe this is true. The transport minister for the country of Iraq recently held a press conference to officially open a new airport in, the Thiqar province. Thiqar province. This is southeastern Iraq. This is the area that is the home of the original civilizations on Earth. The first structured civilizations with specialization of social roles and so forth, you know, where you had a priesthood that didn't have to go out and work in the fields. They were basically just free to tend to the temple stuff and so on. We're talking cities like Eridu, which is considered by most historians and archaeologists the very first city in the world, founded about 5400 BC, okay? Uruk. Uruk, which was the place where Nimrod founded his kingdom, a little northeast of Eridu. So very, very ancient civilization. Again, the first civilizations there, southeast Iraq. Well, this transportation minister, Kazem Finjan, in opening this airport in that region said, and, you know, it just happens to be that this is the location of the very first airport on the world. And I think most viewers to the press conference, like, yeah, really? We thought, you know, Wright brothers, maybe France, America, somewhere there. No, this was built here 5,000 BC, 7,000 years ago, by the ancient Sumerians, from which they flew their spacecraft out into the solar system and discovered the 12th planet, Nibiru. Yes, he's been reading the works of Zechariah Sitchin, the late Zechariah Sitchin, who, as our friend Dr. Michael Heiser puts it, either couldn't read the Sumerian tablets or could read them and just made stuff up anyway. So we can kind of laugh about this. You know, my first thing that came to my mind is, we found out what happened to Baghdad Bob, Saddam Hussein's information minister back in the day. But once we get done with the laughter, you realize enough people believe this that Ancient Aliens has had 9 seasons on the History Channel, you know, with the crazy hair guy. Like I can talk today. Anyway, so it would be funnier if people didn't actually believe this was true. And that's why I bring it up. A lot of the media commentary today is laughing at the transportation minister there, but there are a lot of people who believe Georgia Tsokalos, Zechariah Sitchin, Eric von Däniken, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it is a lie put forth by the enemy to contradict the truth, which is that we are created by God in his image, as his imagers, his moral agents here on planet Earth. We are not the product of an experiment by ancient astronauts or the product of billions of years and random chance. Coming up in A View from the Bunker, this coming Wednesday, October 12th, the final entry in our exclusive series of interviews from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, Stan Dale and L.A. Marzulli. Stan had just a jaw-dropping presentation on the possible location of Atlantis. I mean, everybody wondered after last conference where he pointed out where he thought Eden had been located, and he made a good case for it. What could he do to top it? Well, Atlantis, and it's linked to the Nephilim. So we talked about that. L.A. Marzulli, we also discussed the so-called demon fairy. Now, since then, of course, you know that L.A. and Richard Shaw had that tested by experts. They finally got their hands on it. And in the personal examination, they were able to determine that it was, in fact, a fraud. Sadly, that thing garnered so much attention that it took away from the DNA testing that they had done on one of the deformed skulls from Peru and found some very interesting results there. The DNA haplotype indicating that there was either a European or Middle Eastern origin for the ancestors of that skull. So, but anyway, Stan Dale, L.A. Marzulli, the interviews from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. Then the following Sunday, next Sunday rather, October the 16th, the interview I'd originally scheduled for today, but decided that with the Battle of Dabiq possibly just days away, it was more time sensitive to get this one out to you. Carl Gallups, Pastor Carl Gallups, discusses his new book, When the Lion Roars, and the significance of the prophecies that we see being fulfilled around us today. And then October 23rd, backed up another week, I'd like to bring Trey Smith back up here. That's our plan anyway, and talk with filmmaker Trey Smith. And you'll find those interviews, of course, at vftb.net and online, the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. The Gilbert House Fellowship, our weekly Bible study, two more studies this coming Sunday, God willing, by midday, an hour each of the Old Testament and New Testament as we go through the Bible in chronological order. You can download those and download the entire archive, if you so choose, at gilberthouse.org. And then, of course, Monday, another installment in the audio episode, the audio novel version, audio book version, is what I meant to say, of my novel, The God Conspiracy, releasing it one episode per week until we get through the entire novel. So it's got several months to go, but the action is beginning to heat up. And that is released every Monday morning, a new episode. You'll find those at thegodconspiracy.tk. That's thegodconspiracy.tk. Thank you for taking the time to give us a review and a rating at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download A View from the Bunker. And if you want to comment on the topics we discuss here, log on to the Facebook page, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We do this because we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.